Hey folks, we're back. It's a goodlifevape.com. Jeff and Joel Stales from Bonnaroo and New Orleans. Episode 42.
Everyone, welcome back. It's goodlifevape.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans, recording remotely at Bonnaroo. Day three for us, episode seven. We've had a lot of good guests on the first couple of days. Please go and check them out. They're not time-stamped in the sense of needing to be listened to at Bonnaroo. We're just capturing people's stories, so they're going to be relevant once you get home from your camping trip, because your phone's probably dead. So all you Bonnaroo fans, please check out all the great guests we've had on. We've had nonprofits, we've had political advocates, we've had musicians, we've had
Dave Clements
from Snake and Jake's. That's the Snake and Jake's barn is named after. It's been a fun ride, and we're going to continue to have good guests. And we have a great guest on right now. Greg Harris from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is here with us.
Hey, welcome, guys. You know, I always judge a show by the lead-in music, and whatever you were playing was killer.
Oh, great. Well, that happens to be my band, AKO Jubilee, celebrating our 20-year anniversary. We're based in New Orleans, and if you guys need a band to come up to Cleveland, let me know sometime. All right?
They just played Jazz Fest. They closed the local stage on the local day for their 20th anniversary. It was great.
Well, bring it on. You know, at the museum, everybody thinks of museums as the artifacts and the exhibits and things like that. We're getting really involved in live music too. We're doing 50 days of music this summer. We have a summer stage up.
Oh, 50 days of summer.
Yeah. And just in sort of the shadow of the summer stage, there's a beer garden and there's food.
So it's
trucks.
Outdoors?
It's outdoors.
Wow. And what kind of acts?
Like, well, you know, the idea is to create a vibe when people are walking up that feels like they're entering an experience, like a festival. Like when you're walking through the grounds here, there you just hear sound bleeding from different places. And so we're doing a lot of local bands, but it's not cover bands. We get a lot of local originals. Then we've got some national acts. We have a big show on July 22nd with the Drive-By Truckers. We expect that's going to be just massive.
Yeah, it's amazing. Awesome. And where do people go to find out the lineup?
All right, they can go to rockhall.com. Yeah. And they'll see the whole summer schedule, and it's just a lot happening at the museum. I know we're going to talk about that a bit.
Exactly.
But I guess I want to back up and say it's an honor to be talking to folks from New Orleans, because arguably that's where this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be, for the roots of it all. Now, I have to tell you, I said the same thing in Memphis 2 weeks ago.
Right, of course.
But it's equally true, really, isn't it?
The
music started, went up the river.
It did, and it was a lot of the same players.
Right.
Went up the river, and then they made another stop in Chicago afterwards.
Exactly.
And, you know, Elmore James started in Mississippi.
Right, sure.
And worked his way up. But, you know, like anybody that loves this and has gone back in it and to find out where it came from, all roads lead to New Orleans and, you know, guys like Professor Longhair and sort of that whole thing that sprung forth, and we all love it and celebrate it. And when you hear it, you know it, and it's just great connections.
Yeah.
Well, and if I could say, speaking of that, my girlfriend is from Cleveland, and she went to visit her mother just recently, and I was lamenting not having gone on this trip with her, because I'm like, why have I never been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ever? Because she was sending these photos back, and I have to commend you guys on the curation that's going on there, because she sent a photo of Professor Longhair's business card. And I just gotta say that, like, that level of detail and curation and reading about your history coming from baseball, mm-hmm. and that you're a huge baseball card, I don't want to say fanatic because that's kind of strong, but I mean, that it just seems like it fits, you know, because baseball is a game of minutia and detail and statistics. And just seeing that, I mean, for me, coming from New Orleans and seeing Professor Longhair's business card was amazing. May not sound that amazing to people out there, but who hangs on to that for that long, and how does somebody get a hold of it, and then it makes its way to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Well, that's kind of the key to these museums. First of all, I will mention baseball. I was fortunate to be there for 14 years at the Baseball Hall of Fame, and it's sacred ground to any of us that love the game and grew up with the game or had grandparents that loved it, and music is the same thing. And every single visitor that walks through our front door at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has a reservoir of memory tied to the music that's in the museum. And you hit those sort of touchstones, whether it was the greatest day of your life, whether it was that road trip at a certain time, the time your heart was broken, it's all in the museum. And the key is to not overwhelm people with stuff. But when you see Professor Longhair's business card for you, it humanizes him and it tells a story. And you don't need, you know, generic signed guitars on the walls. That's not what it's about. You don't need, just kind of lots and lots of things. You need certain things that connect you to the people. Then you want to connect the music with it, connect it to the cultural context of when it's happening. And yeah, picture him handing out his card, saying, you know, give me a holler. I'm available, and we can put a combo together. I can play solo. I can do, you know, there's a job there. We've got something like that from Alan Wolf, and it's his banner, his stage banner that he would hang when he was playing, and it's got his phone number on it.
Golly, man, that's just, I mean, for me, it's a thrill. It's a thrill and a half because I'm a huge fan of music from that era. And that kind of level of curation is really something special. And again, I want to commend you guys on that. That's fantastic.
And Greg, back to your personal life, and we'll get back to the hall, but I read a couple articles about you. And normally, we don't do that on It's Good Life, Babe. Jeff and Charles tell us from normal, we just get to know people on the podcast. But I wanted to be prepared, and you seem to have had a Jack Kerouac type of youth. Is that accurate in terms of your sort of hitting the road?
So, you know, it's one of those things where it felt like a zigzag while you were doing it, but then you stand here and look back and it just all fits together.
Right.
And I think, you know, what you're hitting at a little bit is, like so many, just dropping out of college after 2 years, and a buddy and I had opened up a record store, slept in the back, classic old vinyl record store with indie singles and indie albums, as well as a lot of used stuff. And then after a couple years of that, road managing a friend's band for a bit, and ultimately ending up back in school,
right,
getting a degree, trying some things that didn't quite fit with me, and ultimately end up getting a master's in history with an emphasis on everyday people, you know, social history. And then the Baseball Hall of Fame stuff worked out.
Wow.
And it was just a blast. And, you know, that's, I feel very, very fortunate. But, yeah, it was a zigzag.
How was this record store? How did that come to be?
So when I was at school, I had to have, you know, a job to help pay for school. And I was working in a used bookstore in Philly called the Book Trader, a classic place, and they had a little record department. So I was working back there with another guy, and we realized, you know, that the owner was making all the money, and we were getting paid at the time, like, I don't know, $2.65 an hour or something,
sure,
whatever. And we were selling, you know, Frank Zappa's Freak Out for $40.
Right.
And we'd given somebody, you know, $5 for it because you traded it in on credit or whatever.
Sure.
And we sort of thought about it and observed it for a while, and we said, you know what? Let's open up our own place. So we opened up a place about a half a block away. We ran in the store, and we had a little flaw in the plan. We were also sharing an apartment that the bookstore owner owned. So we opened, we realized we had to get out.
You got to get out. Where he kicked you out.
And you know, it was a fun, anybody that kind of has done this sort of, roll up your sleeves and go. We bought plywood and just kind of built bins. Some of the plywood we didn't buy, we found it laying around construction sites, and we just built everything and put our own records in the bins, sold our own stuff first,
yeah,
and then people started walking in the door with stacks of records, and we slowly built up a collection. And it's really exciting for me to say that my original partner, his name is J.C. Webster. Any musician that's traveling through Philly knows this store. It is the place. J.C.'s now had it for 32 years.
Wow.
And it's still cranking. We had a big party 2 years ago for the 30th anniversary. We shut down a pretty big street in Philly called Frankfort Avenue and stuck 8 bands up on stage and just had a blast. So it's still going.
That's
it's
great.
Still working, and I really am, he gets all the credit.
Yeah.
Still got it.
Some of the quotes that I read resonated with me because you're talking to a guy who started a small business from scratch doing sponsorship sales for music promoters,
yep,
for independent music promoters out in Oregon. A guy who started a bar, the Lost Love Lounge, in New Orleans. You know, and it is that sort of just bootstrap, like, I don't want to work for anyone else, I want to work for myself,
yeah,
and just get it done. and get it done in an industry that I care about, where I get to go hang out backstage at music performances, you know.
So I'd say it worked out all right for all three of us.
Exactly. Pretty good. Pretty good so far.
Exactly. But tell us about your time at Bonnaroo. How many, this is your first time, you've been here a bunch?
I came through a couple years ago to check it out for a few reasons. One, we were doing an exhibit about festivals. Again, talking about big subjects, not just, you know, the artists themselves, but we did an exhibit called Common Ground, the Music Festival Experience. And we looked at what was the same with Music Fest from those in the 50s, these gospel fests and other stuff. Newport, right, New Orleans, and then you get, you know, Monterey and Woodstock and Isle of Wight, and just what's the thing about it? And it really is the fans. It's the experience of traveling there. It's the experience of being with your tribe. It's discovering new people, new music, and just kind of being part of it. And, you know, I shared with you guys, my daughter and her childhood friend drove down all in. They had like 17 hours in to be here, nice. Including a bus and a car.
And how old are they?
18 and 19.
Okay.
And what was really great is, like, people did that same trip 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So there's something magical about that.
Absolutely.
And for me being here this time around, well, by the way, that exhibit is over in Austin, Texas right now. It's at the Bullock History Museum. So if any music fans are heading out to Austin for something, you should check it out. It's a really very cool exhibit, and it focuses again on what's common about, you know, why do we gather in fields to hear rock and roll,
right?
Why does it feel so great to do it?
Yeah. And what the answer is, it's the tribe, it's the discovery, right?
Yeah.
The road trip. The I think it's disconnecting from your life for a few days. But what I also love about what Bonnaroo does is that they allow you to continue to have some semblance of your life. So you can do yoga, you can do a 5K run, you can eat good food.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that I love about the concept of this festival.
Yeah, you know, I think you're onto something there, because it is, you do suspend. Ideally, you get to be in a place that frankly feels pretty damn perfect. And
it's like its own city.
Yeah, right? And we all, I think, one of the great things about rock and roll is it believes that things can be perfect. There's an ideal, whether it's a Chuck Berry song about a girl in a car, or whether it's, you know, something else of, you know, a real anthem. But it's also coming together to believe in the same stuff. And one of the things that you believe in is that things can be great, and let's give it a shot for a couple days. And it invigorates the soul. And I've met people here that have been to every single one. This is on their calendar. They're going to have, pretty soon, you know, Bonnaroo's going to have to think, how do we memorialize all these folks?
People.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I've been to, what, 12, I think, myself.
Yeah, I think I've been to 11, as well, because I went to that one.
That I didn't go there. To.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
This is my first time, but it's been great.
Yeah, it's Spencer's first time.
Been double festing.
Spencer, what's your... Yeah, Spencer's been double festing because I'm an old dude and I'm not getting out late. Yeah. You know, I do the early stuff. And so he double fest on my behalf. So he goes out for both of us.
Perfect. Perfect.
So we've been calling him Double Fest Spence.
Yeah. Just make sure you take a few pictures so you remember where you were.
Exactly. He rolled in at 5 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, it was... the sun was out when I finally got back to my tent and went to sleep. Quite a night.
No, nothing like a tent with the sun beating down on it.
Exactly.
Trying to go to sleep.
Well, I'll say, of the 12 years that I've been here, and I think people that I've talked to have been here every single year, this is the best weather Bonnaroo has ever had.
Definitely.
Without question.
Absolutely.
Because it can be super hot and dusty, or it can be super rainy and muddy. And I know people are complaining about it being cold at night. I'm like,
you should be thankful that it's cold at night.
Put it on a layer of clothes, dude.
Yeah.
And shut the fuck up.
And it's wild for this heat and everything. There's no bugs.
Right.
I know.
Except for that wasp in your tent.
I got a wasp.
Just can't find its way out.
We were riffing at the campsite. I don't even know if we're... I'm just going to go there. We were riffing at the camp because we get tangential on the podcast a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Our listeners know that. And then Jeff brings it back to the interview. But we were riffing on, like, James Brown camping. Like, if James Brown was camping.
Yeah,
like, we got a wasp in my tent. It's getting bite in the ass.
I, I love it. I just can't picture James Brown sleeping.
That's a good call.
That's a good call. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we started it because I was lounging out over our like cooler that had food on it in the chair that was too close to the cooler. My feet were getting close to the taco, tortillas. So Jeff was like, get your feet off the food.
We did a nice little a turn on the Eddie Murphy's impersonation of James Brown from back in the early 80s.
So we basically did that for 45 minutes this morning.
So you guys are talking on air all day together. You're sleeping in a tent together too?
No, we are not sleeping together.
Three different tents.
It's the professional.
With air mattresses.
We even have a changing room that we bought for crying out loud. It's like, yeah, we're accommodating ourselves as good as we can.
Well, you know, so the listeners know, I was wondering why you guys are wearing pressed seersucker jackets in these nice... You're definitely the New Orleans guys.
Well, now, I'm trying to wear the NOLA brand every day, so I'm wearing the, what you call the Boogie Gras shirt, which is Boogie Cousins, who got traded to New Orleans right before Mardi Gras. They quickly printed the Boogie Gras shirt, and that's what I'm wearing. It says NOLA big on the front, Mardi Gras colors. And I'm rolling in to come over here to do this interview, and Big Frida says, NOLA, brah! And so I talked to her, and she's going to come on the podcast. So I mean, that's the whole bag.
It's going
to
be great.
People love the New Orleans thing.
Oh, yeah.
For good reason. You know?
I was walking around this morning, and she was leading a big old dance-off. It was sort of a twerking contest.
Oh, right.
And the young and had the person who, Laura, was in here yesterday.
Who's this person?
Yeah, that's right. And she has a business called Sunny Trails, and she organized that whole thing. And that's her thing. It's part of the wellness thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so because her whole bag is she wants to curate yoga to music.
Okay.
So music is part of the movement. So this twerking thing was one of the programs that she did. So we had her on, and we had Skoggins Berg at the same time from Bono's campaign.
One Foundation. One campaign.
Mm-hmm. Which is, they're gathering like 5,000 letters from people here at Bonnaroo. You're gonna love this. And they're distributing them to state Senate Capitol Hills to basically to protest the foreign aid cuts that Trump is proposing.
Wow, love it. Well, it's a great place
That's what's amazing, the activism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the back to the wellness and the yoga thing, we started something at the museum with a group in Cleveland that has been a real leader in this. And they call it Believe and Cleave, and
nice.
On our plaza, so our museum's this pyramid, right? And if anybody has seen our pyramid, it's the same as the one at the Louvre, same architect. And we like to say that's the home of Europe's great art. We're the home of America's great art, rock and roll. But they had almost 3,000 people on our plaza doing yoga with rock and roll cranking. And it's, you know,
wow.
It wasn't Big Frida. It was more like, you know, open, big sound things. I think U2 was in the mix. And it was really pretty beautiful. And the photos of it, when you see a couple thousand people out there doing yoga, you think when people see this in 500 years from now, they're going to swear this was a religious ceremony.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
when the cockroaches have taken over and the aliens come down and they find that, they're going to be like, they're going to put it in their Bible, or what are the cockroach Bible?
It'll be in their museum.
Exactly. And they won't understand it.
So let me ask you, what are some of the big developments right now for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yeah. So we're now 22 years old. Back when, I do know New Orleans was lobbying for it. I'm from Philly. Philly was lobbying for it. Memphis, a bunch of cities. So Cleveland got it, built the museum. And those 22 years that we've had it in Cleveland, we've had almost 12 million visitors. And powerful, great place. But the place needed to be continually refreshed. And we're in a mode right now where we're doing some major transformations to the museum. We took, again, the outdoor plaza, all that activity is new and ties to what we're doing. People should go to the website and check it out. And then inside, a big thing with museums these days is a great food experience. We partner with a bunch of local celebrity chefs, and we have a cafe that's, the charge was, we want great beer, great coffee, and fresh and local food. And so there's that. Nice. That's happening. We put some new exhibits in. We have one that tells the backstage story. We have one on the top three floors that's the 50th anniversary of Rolling Stone magazine.
Wow, that's great.
Unbelievable history. And then we're working on a theater that's going to open up on July 1st. And this is a huge thing for us. We engaged Jonathan Demme, the great director, great filmmaker.
Rest his soul.
We engaged him last summer, and he went through 32 years of induction footage. And we said, take this and pick the most emotional pieces and tell a story in 12 minutes, and we want to put it in an immersive theater so people see. And I'll use an example, like when Prince passed away, that great "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" solo.
Yeah.
That was at our induction on our stage.
Right.
And we have 32 years worth of magic moments like that. So Jonathan took them. It was a fun project for him because he hadn't worked in this format. And the idea was, if there's stuff on screen, like these screens surround you, there's also concert lighting and there's visual effects that augment it. And so he got to kind of design the show and then work with the people that do the effects to make it even more emotional. And we're going to open that on July 1st.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I had a chance to play for Jonathan Demme's birthday party.
He dug New Orleans music.
I know. And he was down there for a while. We played for his birthday party at the Ernie Cato Mother-in-Law Lounge.
At the Ernie Cato Mother-in-Law Lounge.
Yes, that's right.
What a small, wild world we're in.
Good.
Well, he was a passionate filmmaker. And yes. What's neat is he had a real sensitivity to music. In his non-musical films, music was always used really effectively and powerful. Think about Philadelphia. But in his musical films, his Neil Young films, Stop Making Sense was groundbreaking. And one of the things we talked about, so we traveled together to go look at some other museums, and the thing that we got into, one of the deepest things was talking about the Mardi Gras Indians. He'd shot hours of it.
Yeah.
And was trying to get something together. And we were hanging with a guy that you may know. You know Robert Gordon, the writer from Memphis?
Do not.
I don't.
So anyway, we got into it about the Wild Magnolias and Wild Chapatulas and sort of all those things. It was kind of fun because here's this guy that's made massive Hollywood blockbusters, mm-hmm. and he wants to get this documentary out that he's dying to do because these bands are so important. And
the Indians on Mardi Gras Day, it's like, I mean, that's what I do.
Yeah.
Jeff and I spent 2 hours this Mardi Gras. We went out to the Zulu parade.
Cool.
First at 7 in the morning, and then we were like, we gotta go find Indians. And the funny, interesting thing about Mardi Gras Day is, I mean, that's when you want to see the Indians, right? Obviously. And it took us, 2 hours and walking like 3 miles.
Yeah. Well, like, and where did we put a pin on it finally? In front of the Ernie Cato Mother-in-Law.
Exactly.
You should have stayed there.
When we got over
there. And six big chiefs were there.
Oh, man.
All together.
Yeah.
So, and it was just a magical moment. And I'm like, okay, my Mardi Gras is good.
Yeah. I was lucky enough, and again, through this Robert Gordon, I started going to New Orleans in the kind of middle 80s, and we got turned on to Thelma's Glass House and heard great music there, and then marched one Mardi Gras with the Wild Magnolias.
Wow.
And it was just, you're right. You do that, you don't need to go anywhere else.
No, you don't need to go to the French Quarter or anything.
Yeah.
And hey, shout out to the Backstreet Museum in New Orleans, everybody.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Speaking of museums, are you hip to the Backstreet Museum at all?
I'm not.
It's a little, basically, it's just a house in the Treme, mm-hmm. and it's a museum dedicated to the Mardi Gras Indians.
It's a grassroots Mardi Gras Indian museum
that
was basically put together by one individual. And I don't know if it's been helped by grants and grant writing or if there's infrastructure at this point.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those great New Orleans things where you could go to this guy's house and you could see this fantastic exhibit.
See the costumes.
Of the costumes. And
labor
and
of love.
The photos.
Yeah, labor of love.
And I always tell people when they come to New Orleans, they're like, that's the thing you have to do. Gotta go to the Backstreet Museum.
So it sounds like also that maybe you have some traveling exhibits as well, and that you partner with museums in other cities?
We do. We have one right now that's a very timely exhibit called Louder Than Words, Rock, Power, and Politics. And we had it up in Cleveland all last summer for the campaign season through the election. And it's now in Washington, D.C. at a great museum called the Newseum.
Yeah, I know that. I'm familiar.
Yeah.
It's a great museum. Holy cow. Yeah. People complain that you have to pay, like, whatever it is, $20 to get in, but it is so worth it.
Yeah, it's a powerful place, and it tells the whole story of you know, the news media, but really it's the story of how all of us process events and activities and what it impacts us. They've got an exhibit there that floored me. That was their 9/11 exhibit. Really wow. Amazing. So we have an exhibit there. That it's going to leave there. It's going to travel and go to some presidential libraries. It's going to go to the Ford Library in Michigan, the Clinton Library in Arkansas, which is kind of close to New Orleans, and then it's going to go over to Houston, to the Bush Library.
Wow. You got all that done?
What's that?
You got all that done?
Well, our team. We got it done, and we're booking it, and it's exciting.
That's so great to have what you're doing on the road.
And then we have the one in Austin that I mentioned, exactly. The festivals exhibit, and we have an exhibit about Paul Simon as a songwriter that's out in L.A. at the Skirball Museum.
Wow, that is so great to extend out into the rest of the country. Good work.
Thank you. Good work. We Cleveland isn't the easiest place to get to, although it's within a... it's a drive from like 80% of the population or 60% of the population. It's not bad, but we want to go where people are and tell these stories and have an impact.
And go into other cities where music was, music started in different forms and variations.
I feel like a little bit in New Orleans, one of the things that we have a difficulty with is...
Honoring our past.
Honoring our past in a way that... it's hard for me to envision how the Rock Hall of Fame would partner with a museum in New Orleans. I know that there are some, but they don't have a big footprint. It's something that I've always thought that we've missed. We obviously had the monument controversy in New Orleans just recently that everybody knows about across the country. And I think that we're at a crossroads right now where I think that we can have that discussion and we can talk about ways to move forward. Does the Rock Hall get involved in stuff like that? Because I feel like there's so many, obviously, musicians.
Yeah.
And there's such... We just need a place in New Orleans where we can have a museum to New Orleans music. I mean, Cosmos Studio is a laundromat right now.
Exactly. I mean, right now, all we have Armstrong Park.
Yeah. That's right.
And that's it.
That's right.
Well.
So we've got a Buddy Bolden statue, a Louis Armstrong statue, a second line generic sort of art installation.
Right.
We have Congo Square.
Yeah.
And look, we have the World War II Museum, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's
doing exactly.
Great, yeah. Right?
Right.
But imagine if we had that. What would you say would be the way forward for a town like New Orleans to get something like that together?
I think that the one thing that, being from a distance with New Orleans, what's great is that music's still alive, and it's such a big true. Thing. And so the key is whatever's done has to connect, not just tell the story of the past, but connect yesterday and today. And that's kind of the magic of it. There was an exhibit in that museum near Jackson Square that was kind of the history of New Orleans music.
Right, right.
I don't know what happened to that.
Oh, the Pontalba or the, the Cabildo.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that, again, that's even the key for us up in Cleveland, is you don't just tell, like, the story of the roots. Or say you do the blues story. The blues story is, of course, we can do Robert Johnson or Charlie Patton and Elmore James and Muddy Waters and all of that sort of stuff. But where it really gets even more teeth is if you do it through the eyes in the connections of Gary Clark, right? You take somebody that's contemporary and you make it relevant so that we're talking about our kids, so that my daughter who likes him suddenly says, oh, this is where it came from and I can connect it. And if I'm one of these, real purist, I can learn that, there are artists that are still playing stuff, and like Keb Moe's latest record was unbelievable. Kind of be able to connect through there. That's where it gets a lot of power and magic. The other thing is, museums are kind of, you don't want the exhibit to be a fixed space. You want activity and programming. And the city of New Orleans has a ton of stuff happening. It's happening though at small venues, it's happening hopefully at public parks and things like that. In Cleveland, we have a program where we honor artists typically every year, and one year we honored Fats and Dave were our honorees.
Oh, that's great.
And to do that, we brought up the Rebirth Brass Band, we brought up a bunch of other people to perform in their honor. That's a way to connect yesterday and today that I think I would encourage any city to do. As I think about New Orleans from a distance, I just assume it's going really well, and that people are there because of music, and it has that vibe. There's a balancing act with, you know, is it the plastic cup vibe of Bourbon Street, and is it bachelorette parties? There's nothing wrong with that stuff happening. But
it's not. I mean, it is. We have a vibrant, to your point, a residency. You know, the Rebirth Brass Band still plays in the Maple Leaf every Tuesday night. Walter Wolfman Washington plays at DBA every Wednesday night. So we have this. Like,
he also really comes into Pal's Lounge
and gets on our podcast.
And comes on our podcast,
which happened on his birthday. So, and you still got the John Cleary weekly show. So the residency thing, the weekly residency thing, is super strong in New Orleans. And then the second line is super strong in New Orleans. We go out to the second line.
I would say stronger than ever.
Stronger than ever. We'll go out to the second line. There's 5,000 people out there every Sunday.
Wow.
And it's just rocking.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm a museum guy, but if it's alive and living,
exactly.
You know, maybe, exactly. maybe it would be nice to have a singular place. But really, the history and tradition can't be transmitted any better.
It is a living culture. Absolutely. The second line is a living culture. And we talk about this all the time. It's multi-generational. So you'll see a grandma, a daughter, and a granddaughter out of the second line together. And the kids and the teenagers are into it.
Yeah.
Like kids, you know, that your daughter's age come out to the second line, and they're wearing all like the hip clothes. We talk about this all the time. Like all these like hipster black kids are wearing like these like heavy metal t-shirts.
Yeah, it's like Metallica and Slayer.
It's like, how's that happening?
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
But they're out at the second line and loving it, right?
Crossover thing that's happening, you know, with the younger generation that is really kind of amazing to behold.
This cultural appropriation thing is happening both ways now.
I dig it. You know, music is so accessible these days through your digital platforms.
Right.
And we all think the way we got it was the best, right?
Sure, right, right.
But if you think about having to, if you heard,
I don't know, I didn't like my Walkman that much.
Yeah, but if you heard the song on the radio, or if you saw the band, you then had to go find the record, and you go to record stores or department stores or wherever you got it.
Right.
Then you had to take it home.
Right.
And then you had to play it, and you may have heard one song, and you sort of listen intently to love it as much as you did that time when you move the needle around, you set it down.
Sure.
And I believe because of that, I used to feel, well, I still do, that you invested time so you listened differently and you wanted to make it work. Now you can just, you know, kids can swipe their thumb and get to the next song. But the flip is the accessibility. And a buddy that was a huge blues collector, probably some of your listeners are out, you know, chasing 78s and kind of doing all that. He said to me one day, my daughter, who's a high school senior, knows more about the blues than I'm ever going to know.
Because
she can sit at her laptop and she can see, Hound Dog Taylor, and then she can sort of connect the dot from him to Elmore James, and or she can start somewhere completely different and find her way back. And then there's some guy in Belgium leaving a comment next to the YouTube clip that says, if you like that, check this out.
Exactly.
Yeah, we have a fan in the Netherlands. Shout out to Amsterdam Phil. Right, a big fan of the
podcast.
It's
probably him that's leaving those comments.
That's how, you know, to your point, I try not to get hung up on the presentation of music like some people do, and I get the whole thing about the artistry of the placement of the song within the concept of an LP. But when people lament the passing of the LP format a lot of times, I'm like, hey, look, you have to go back in time into, you know, before, I don't know, when was the LP, 67, 68, 66, sometime around that era is when the LP came around. And then I'm like, before that, you had singles, you know? So we are back in a singles download kind of era, which is what you had a record that had two sides, you know, and that's what you had, A and B side. Yeah. You had one song on each side.
Right, yeah. No, I think you're dead on. It's, and they get sort of to find ways to discover and share. And I feel the artist should, of course, be compensated, and people should be able to make a living doing this, and you don't want that digital piece to undermine it. But the fact that the kids can dig on this stuff, and you know, I'm always surprised because, again, we have teenagers in the house with the stuff that they find, and then oftentimes it points back, though, to the classics. And somewhere in it all, you know, they're playing a Try a Little Tenderness by Otis Redding, and you're thinking, where'd that come from?
Yeah,
you know?
That's my karaoke go-to.
Is it really? All right.
Well, I gotta say, Spencer has been in charge of our playlist back at the campsite, and it's been running the gamut. And some of the newer bands that we've been listening to on there, I'm sitting there going like, wow, these guys really sound 90s to me, you know, for crying out loud. But Spencer has an amazing mind for references in movies and music, and, you know, he's been leading the charge on that for us. So thank you, Spencer. I appreciate that. Yeah.
So you're the young guy on this team, huh?
Yeah, I'm the millennial for the
group. He's our millennial producer.
The token millennial.
Exactly. We got to have somebody to keep us up with the time.
We met Spencer at a bar like 6 weeks ago. And just said, hey, do you want to come on the team? Now he's at Bonnaroo freaking out.
Oh, what a guy.
he impressed us because he knew the film Earth Girls Are Easy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, yeah.
Is that Harvey Korman? I don't remember. Was that a Harvey Korman film?
Was that a Harvey Korman film?
That
was Julie Brown. Yeah, that was in that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, the truth is, it's like the putting bands together. You said, Spencer, do you have a car?
Exactly.
But I'll tell you a funny thing that happened there was that, so my birthday was recent, and we went there.
To the Pals Lounge.
Right, exactly, because we like to partner with the local businesses and go there and to have a drink or two while we're there as well, when we're celebrating. And Walter Wolfman Washington rolls through. Right, and so we're like, Walter, do you want to come on the show? And we were so humbled that he was willing to do that, and so he comes on, and we're talking to him, and he starts regaling us with stories about his time playing with Lee Dorsey.
Oh yeah,
and so our sound man friend Griper Nugent was doing sound for us for that episode, and he's like, I have to ask you, how did you guys tour? What did you ride in to do your tours? Blah, blah, blah. He's like, did you have a van or anything? He's like, no, we had a big red Cadillac. Convertible.
Perfect.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So we get those stories from a guy like Walter, and that's so fantastic. And New Orleans has that, where you can just run into people like that.
And he also told us about an album that Ben Elman from Galactic's producing for him that's gonna drop in January.
Oh, my God.
Talking about yesterday and today. That's killer, yeah.
Exactly.
And he's doing an album. He's doing, for the first time, ballads, I think, is what he was saying, that he's never done before.
He's going to do some, you're familiar with the Danny Barker record, the solo record. I don't know. If you're not, I should send you a copy of that, because that's a fantastic record that he did in the early 80s. But it's kind of the seminal Danny Barker record. It's just him with a guitar playing tunes that he liked and some that he wrote as well.
Yeah.
And that's a big time famous record in New Orleans, gets played on OZ all the time. Right. And it sounds like Walter is making a record in that vein.
Wow.
And so there's gonna be some band performance, but it's gonna be limited, maybe possibly acoustic, and there's gonna be some stuff where he's just playing on his own. Everybody's looking forward to it. Looks like it's going to drop in January of next year.
Yeah, and that again, to your point, that ties the past to the present, because Walter's been around forever. Yeah. I mean, he's one of the legendary blues players from New Orleans. And for him to, and this might be his seminal sort of moment in his career towards the end of it.
Yeah,
frankly.
Right, that's right.
There was a similar, and I would expect it'll probably go, you know, when Arthur Alexander put out that record after sort of being, MIA, at least to the world, for 20 years, driving a bus and living a life.
Wow.
Yeah. Then this record comes out, and he performed at one of the bigger, you know, industry gatherings, and was like, they were stacking up festival appearances and everything, and unfortunately he ended up having a heart attack and passing away. I think it was a heart attack. But like the record itself, you hear it, and I would have think the care and the love and the passion comes through, and they do. You know, we're listening differently now, and I think that more people are exposed to this and ready for it, and it could be just great timing. I can't wait to hear it.
Greg, one quick question: the most forward-facing thing that the Rock Hall does is the induction. Clearly, I know everybody asks you about this. I'm glad that we took the time to talk about the other things that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame does. What's your role in the induction process?
So the museum is 22 years old, and that's my charge, right? My specific oversight of that and leading our team and really growing it. There's a group called the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation that are our great partners and friends, and they've been inducting people for 32 years, even before the museum existed.
Wow.
They were inducting people. And I am involved with them, and they're the group that everybody is lobbying to get the museum built in their city, and they license the rights to Cleveland to have it. We work hand in glove with them on much of what we do, and they're great collaborators. They're also great supporters. They raise funds through the induction dinner to donate it all to the museum. Wow. And help it happen. So now the election process is something I think people should, it's worth explaining to folks, because there's some misconceptions out there. It's two steps. First, there's a ballot that gets created. And the way the ballot is created, there's a group of about 24, 25 people. It's a face-to-face meeting. Everybody nominates two. And then you do a round of voting in that room. And when you nominate your picks, you make a case for why they should be inducted. And listeners should know it has nothing to do with record sales. It has nothing to do with a chart position. It's all about impact and influence. And right. It's one of the reasons why some of the mega sellers, why the Velvet Underground goes in before
Journey
or Rush or
whatever. Right, fans. Right. So, yeah. And, of course.
And the idea is, the great quote, I think it's a quote from maybe it's Lenny Kaye that said that, the Velvets sold 10,000 records, everybody that bought them formed bands. Everybody nominates and you whittle it down to a ballot of roughly 15. That ballot then goes out to about 800 voters in the single largest voting body are all the other inductees. So when that goes out, Aretha Franklin has a vote, Smokey Robinson has a vote, Bono has a vote, Fats is a voter. And the idea is they made their living in rock and roll in this art form so they can judge the merits of their peers.
Oh, that's a great system.
And then the top five vote-getters are elected.
Right.
So that's how it works. Now, that group, I said it was, 800. The inductees are close to 700 because you have multiple members in bands, and you have bands with a lot of members like Parliament and Chicago and things. So the other, it's augmented by rock and roll critics, some writers, and some university-based historians.
Okay, right. Musicologists.
So it's unlike the sports museums, where you can measure and say, all right, somebody hit 600 home runs.
Sure.
They won 300 games. These magical, quantifiable
you
things.
Yes. Have a
yeah, that's right.
You can't be in if you didn't hit above 275.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this is totally subjective. Sure. And it has to do with taste, and it has to do with, but the core of it is impact and influence. You had to have made a record at least 25 years earlier to be eligible, and then once you're eligible, you go through that ballot process, and then you go. So that's kind of how election happens.
Uh-huh.
And there is one other avenue. There's a small committee that does the early influences. Mm. And that's the idea of putting some of these early influences out to that general voting body. Isn't quite the same as some real experts looking at who were those early influences and how do they fit.
Right.
And this is probably when you should ask about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Okay.
She's not in yet.
Exactly. I was going to say Lee Dorsey, but I'm going to lobby hard for Lee Dorsey for what it's
yes,
worth.
Yes, indeed.
But,
so influential. Lee Dorsey.
Yeah, I think so. At the turn of funk, when that was happening, with the Meters backing him up and everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
I agree. Well, it's the Meters.
Exactly.
Or another.
Exactly.
They're not in yet.
They're not in yet.
We got to get
that. Got it. They have.
Yeah. This is taking a turn here, guys.
Well, look, I think we're getting close to wrapping up here. We've been rolling about 40 minutes.
I want to ask one other question. Okay, so you're from Philly,
yeah.
Right? And then you have your baseball background at the museum there. But now you're a prominent citizen in Cleveland, mm-hmm. right? And so how do you divide your sports fandom?
That's a great question.
Because Cleveland took it to him last night.
They did. I believe that it's so much. Life is so much better, and you're so invested when you root for your home team.
That's right.
So yeah, I'm a Indians fan. I'm a Cavs fan. I'm rooting for the Browns as well. But the Indians and Cavs are they're my teams. I follow. That's who we take our kids to see. Now I do peek at the National League. So I do peek at what the Phillies are doing.
Sure.
But we're all in as a community, and you kind of have to all stand, back to back and take.
It is so much better when you do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got Spencer lives in New Orleans, and he's wearing his Dallas Cowboys jacket.
Spencer, like, dude, front runner, man, come on.
You gotta come around.
We get him. We'll get him eventually.
Yeah, you know, these are powerful things because, Spencer, you're going against your family when you do that. But, you know, you gotta root for the home team.
You gotta root for the home team.
Well, once the home team has 5 Super Bowls, maybe I'll...
You're killing me, bro. All right.
So the other caveat of that is in the baseball world, when you're visiting a ballpark, and I was lucky enough as part of my job, you'd be out there seeing games, and you'd be hosted by the team. You rooted for them.
Right, of course.
You had to.
That makes sense.
You know, it's but these are, it's fun to talk about these things, and you guys get it. You know, you're music people through and through, but you're in an unbelievable community, and the connection, the power that that these things bring to people is incredibly special. We're kind of fun to be able to sit here and talk about it, then unplug and go hear great music tonight.
Exactly. Who are you gonna see tonight? Do you know?
Let's see. Before I say that, I was sitting with somebody in a tent over here, and it was our first Bonnaroo, and we were talking about, you know, U2 played last night, and there was a bunch of EDM stuff, and I said, who'd you see last night? She said, I saw U2, and we saw this EDM, and she named a couple bands. She said, but then I saw this, like, Conservation Hall. and I said, Conservation Hall? And she said, they were unbelievable. And I said, yeah. And it was, I think it was at 1 or 2 in the morning. And my first question to her, and this is her first Bonnaroo, I'll, you know, paint the picture. You know, she came down from Nashville, and she had never been here before, sort of middle-aged. And I said, so you heard the Preservation Hall jazz? And she said, yeah, they were the greatest. And I said, did you dance? And she said, all night long.
That's great. That's so great. So we're trying to have them on later on today.
Yeah, come on.
We're going to see.
Man, if they could just squeeze a few instruments in this room.
Boy, that'd be something.
Exactly.
So I need to look at my schedule to see who I'm seeing tonight. But I know that I've got... God, I'll peek quickly.
And you're going to make sure to see some stuff with your daughter, right?
Yes. Just that's
to have that connective tissue with her.
Without getting in the way or being the
exactly.
the old guy, right?
strike a balance. Dad.
So I want to run over and see Lucas Nelson. You know, these guys, the promise of the real, they were back in Neil Young, right?
Okay.
Oh, right.
So I want to see that. There's sort of a trashy band, Deep Valley, that I want to check out. And then Cage the Elephant later.
Yes,
definitely.
Great.
Definitely want to see him. So,
sweet
guys, you have an open invite to come up to Cleveland. All your listeners, come up and check us out. And we feel a kinship with New Orleans because we all are passionate about music. We're kind of cities that have to continue to fight. We have to continue to keep our identity.
That's right.
And, that's right.
I believe again, Philly as well. These are cities that have a lot of soul, and it's all about the people.
That's right.
And folks, if you get a chance, go up to Cleveland. Cleveland gets a bad rap a lot of times, but Cleveland has been on the rise. And there's a lot of good stuff going on there these days. I can attest to that, having not ever visited it myself, but because my girlfriend is from there, visits frequently, and I know that that's happening. And so, Greg, I want to thank you for being on the show. Thanks so much.
Hey,
Greg, it's a pleasure.
So much.
Okay, and, thanks, guys.
Everybody visit, what's the website again?
Rockhall.com.
Rockhall.com. And check out everything they're doing. It's great work, and so glad to have you on.
Thank you.
Look for us on Twitter, folks. We're going to do a shout out to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we'll catch you on the next podcast, which is coming up in about an hour from now.
It's a good life, babe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans via Bonnaroo.